So last class we finished up Apostolate 3, which was Unitary Transformations, and you know, in my notes, which you will get probably in a day or two, so you can focus more on the lecture rather than taking notes. So not everything I say will be in the typeset notes, but most of it will. There's a discussion of the Heisenberg picture in here, and I won't cover it. I assume that's pretty basic, so I'll skip it. Let's talk a little bit about sequential measurements and state update. We're going to come back to this and have a full section on the theory of measurement. But for now, this is just a little bit of a teaser. Let's consider that we're measuring an observable, consider some self-adjoint operator A. Okay, and that means A has spectral decomposition. So the AL are the eigenvalues, which are possibly degenerate, and these are projectors onto the eigenspaces associated with each distinct AL. Then we know that the probability of observing outcome L is equal to the trace of rho PL, where rho is the preparation. The quantum state. Now the question is, what is the state after the measurement? What is rho after? Let's call it rho prime. After the measurement. Okay, so the answer is it depends. Okay, there are several considerations we have to take into account. So the common thing you learn in textbooks, which my job here is to tell you which parts of that are wrong, okay? So the part you hear in textbooks is that, so the standard textbook answer is what? You guys must have all read it. What's the standard textbook answer? Collapse. Collapse, but more precisely, what? Give me a mathematical, I want a mathematical answer.
Projection onto the eigenspace.
Right. So the standard expert is that, and I'll say that mathematical statement in words, the system is left in an eigenstate in the eigenstate associated with the observed outcome. Okay? Do you believe that? Is that a rule? Is that always true? Okay, consider this. What happens if I have a photon of a certain energy and I absorb it with a calorimeter? Calorimeter is a bunch of glass that's infused with lead. This is the standard technique in high energy physics experiments to measure gamma rays or whatever energy photon you have. So you make glass, you infuse it with lead, and then behind this wall of lead glass, a lot like what you would have like on a bathroom, you're going to have a whole bunch of photomultipliers, which will measure the emitted radiation. Am I confusing this? Okay, I'm making this too complicated. Let's simplify it. consider a standard photomultiplier. All right, how does a photomultiplier work? Photomultiplier measurement of photon energy. Okay, this is an example. Okay, so how does that work? Well, you have some kind of lens, and then you have a whole bunch of plates, and then some kind of metal plate at the end attached to some wire, which goes into electronics. And what you have is a positive charge here, and a positive voltage here, and a negative voltage on these plates.
Yeah, they have to have different negative voltages, right? The large ones on the left. And
yeah, there has to be like a gradient of negative voltages. But here, let's just put a grate here and just make that negatively charged just for simplicity. We're not worried about optimal design here. We're just worried about showing how it works. So now the photon comes in. It has energy h nu. It's in an eigenstate of energy or energy momentum. Photon comes in, and so let's move it up a little bit. And it's going to hit this plate, this metallic plate. And then one of the first experimental discoveries that prompted Einstein to recognize the quantization of light, the photoelectric effect. So what happens is the energy of the photon, if it's high enough above threshold, it can eject an electron. So now you have an electron gets kicked out. Now this electron gets accelerated by the voltage difference across the longitudinal direction of the tube. So it speeds up and smashes into this plate, which then ejects a whole bunch more electrons. Okay, and then they smash into this plate, and then you get an avalanche. This is sometimes called an avalanche detector. You get an avalanche of electrons which are attracted to this plate, which form a current which is proportional to the incident energy. Okay? And then by measuring this current, so this is supposed to be a proportional to, current I is proportional to the incident energy of the photon. And we measure this signal with our electronics, and we get an estimate of the energy of the photon to some precision. Is the photon left in an energy eigenstate after it's been measured? No. All right, so this is clearly some kind of provisional rule, and it depends very much on how you do the measurement. Okay, so there's certain kinds of measurements which are non-destructive, for which this rule is going to apply, and there are other kinds of measurements which are destructive, for which this rule is not going to apply. Yes?
But this rule applies to measurement of a closed system, right? This is not a closed system because you have to interact with electrons and everything. So you have a low-level quantum system. So, I mean, you wouldn't expect that standard textbook answer to be applicable anyway in that situation, right?
I don't know what you mean by closed system. If you're doing a measurement, there is no such thing as a closed system under measurement.
This is true, yes, but the textbook answer is a procedure that works for this. I mean, you have really a macroscopic system and one microscopic degree of freedom. And this example, I don't think it's a very good counter example because it's a really quantum example, you know?
Oh,
so why wouldn't you describe the electrons as well by principles of quantum mechanics? I don't know. I'm not very happy with this example.
No, that's fine. That's fine. You're allowed not to be happy. The point is the principle's wrong, okay? So let's just build up examples to come up with a better understanding of when it is correct. Let's consider another issue with this rule. Let's suppose A3 is doubly degenerate. Okay, so this means that P3 has rank 2. It's a rank 2 projector. And suppose now under measurement, so that means we can write P3 as phi1, phi2, plus, let me call it phi1, 3, phi 1, 3 plus phi 2, 3, phi 2, 3, where phi 1, 3, phi 2, 3 are orthogonal. Lessons 0. Okay, well, here, maybe this I and J. Okay, so I'm measuring this observable. I get outcome A3. Outcome A3 is observed. Yes?
Sorry, but I can't read the superscript.
So the superscript here is a parenthetical 1, parenthetical 1, parenthetical 2, parenthetical 2. What I'm doing here is just, you know, with some kind of heavy-handed notation. Point is P3 is a rank 2 projector, so it projects onto a rank, onto a two-dimensional Hilbert space, which means that Hilbert space is going to be spanned by two orthogonal states. And so I'm just defining two orthogonal states. Okay, so then what is the eigenstate? What is the eigenstate associated with A3? Yes.
Then wouldn't this be very easily be improved upon by saying, like, is that in the eigenstates associated with the observed eigenvalue?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, there's definitely, this is a solved problem. I'm not, this is an open problem. I'm just giving you examples of how this simple principle is problematic. Okay, we have to have a more refined notion. So I'm justifying a more refined notion.
Didn't you just say that you have a new matrix, which is the projection of the old matrix?
Yeah, well, your answer was exactly right. I'm just explaining to the other students what considerations we need to generalize this. So, so the update rule for a certain class of ideal measurements is the Luders rule. Which is rho evolves to rho prime, which is equal to P, it's called PL, PL rho PL divided by trace rho PL when outcome L is observed. So now, saying outcome L is just shorthand for saying outcome AL, right? It's the same information. L is the index for A. Okay, so this completely solves this problem. It handles arbitrary high-rank projectors. It shows that this rule of thumb is a little bit vague, but it doesn't really solve this problem, which is there are cases of non-ideal measurements where one is not left with the system in some eigenspace of the observed outcome. Okay, let's make this concrete with an example. For those of you who aren't familiar with projecting onto an eigenspace, we're going to assume that we have an input state psi is equal to c1 phi1 plus c2 phi2 plus c3 phi3. We'll assume is normalized, so that means we have sum over I ci squared is equal to 1. And then we're going to let, we're going to define p1 equal to phi 1 phi 1, and we're going to define a p perp which is equal to phi 2 phi 2 plus phi 3 phi 3. So the idea is that these are perpendicular because phi 1 phi 2 is equal to phi 1 phi 3, which is equal to 0. Similarly, phi 2 and phi 3 are orthogonal. Actually, why don't I just write this more compactly as phi I phi j is equal to delta I j. So this is our input state. We want to express the input state as a density operator. So our input state is equal to psi psi, which we can write out explicitly. And I'll do this in full because some of you may not be familiar with density operators or comfortable yet. So what we get is we get C1 squared phi 1 phi 1 plus C2 squared phi 2 phi 2 plus C3 squared phi 3 phi 3 plus the coherence terms. So these are the populations on the diagonal if we write this density matrix in this basis. And then because it's a coherent state, it's a pure state, we have cross terms of the form C1, C2 bar. What does this work? I want the bar here. So this is phi 1, phi 2. So I have a complex conjugation because this is the dual vector. Plus C1, C3, phi 1, phi 3. Plus C2, C3, phi 2, phi 3, plus the complex conjugates of these three terms. Okay, no typos? Is there some, yeah?
What do you mean by rho in, is that say in?
I mean the state that we're going to goes into the measurement apparatus. The state of the system we're going to measure. I'll just delete it. All right, so this is rho. It's this rho right here, the one on the left-hand side of the arrow. So you can do this rho in, rho out, rho, rho prime. I was mixing up my notation, so thanks for catching that. I'm doing this wrong. Okay, so if we obtain outcome 1, then rho prime is equal to P1 rho P1 over trace of rho P1. Can anyone tell us what this denominator is doing here? Perfect. Okay, good. And then what's that going to be? It's going to be phi 1, phi 1. All right, the C1 magnitude squared cancels out. So then we have a normalized output state. So essentially, we've renormalized the state, which is hiding something. The fact that we've renormalized the state to describe the output, I don't know, this is kind of an open-ended question. Does anyone know what fact that's hiding? The fact that we've renormalized this. We could have dropped this term and left it subnormalized. What does that correspond to physically? No, maybe. Maybe that's related. What I'm fishing for here is the fact that you're throwing away systems. So if I do this measurement 1,000 times, I'm going to get outcome 1 a fraction of the time, which is C1 magnitude squared, right? That's the fraction of times I get outcome 1 by the Born rule, which means that if I want to describe the output systems, I have to throw away the other fraction, 1 minus C1 squared. I'm throwing away that fraction of systems. So here I'm describing a subensemble of systems, which is those for which I obtain outcome 1. Now, if I obtain, so this is the standard collapse rule. If we obtain outcome perp, which is essentially outcome 2 or 3, I'll put that in the correct brackets. Then something interesting happens. Rho prime is equal to p perp rho p perp over trace of rho p perp, which is going to be c2 squared phi 2 plus c3 squared phi 3 plus c2 c3 bar. And this is the interesting piece. We preserve the coherence between states 2 and 3. So the relative phase between states 2 and 3 is preserved via this high rank measurement. And then we have to normalize it. So let me put this all in a bracket and divide by this guy, which is c2 squared plus c3 squared. So the coherence between subspace 2, 3 and subspace 1 is destroyed by the measurement. And the coherence of the orthogonal subspace is in the orthogonal subspace is preserved. Now, the reason I hesitated at the beginning of this is because there's much more interesting things to say if we've already introduced kind of density operators in full, which we haven't really. I mean, this is a pure state. So I kind of feel like I should do density operators first, but I guess we'll get to that later. Okay, so good. So that's the state update rule. We won't discuss its conceptual significance. We'll come to that later. I'm sure there's a mixture of disappointment and relief amongst you about that. Okay, any questions about the kind of bare bones of the update rule? Oh, I guess I have some remarks here I can read. Let me read my remarks and then, tell you my remarks and then, okay, so where I said this is called either the projection postulate, the von Neumann-Luders rule, or collapse of the wave function, or the state update rule. It's at the heart of the measurement problem. There is a classical analog for this, which we'll discuss later. So this is not a quantum process. I already mentioned that. Okay, why isn't it a postulate? Why do I not elevate it to the level of a postulate? As I mentioned briefly to someone after class, and perhaps also during class, last class, the point here is that we have a process which produces an output state. Okay, so here we have our measurement process. So we have our light, we have our dial, which determines what we're measuring, and we have our pointer readout. Okay, so now we get some readout that says outcome perp, which is 2 or 3. And now we want to describe, so this is rho, and this is rho prime, which is now conditioned on a specific outcome. Viz pointer position. Okay? So think about this now as this is also a preparation procedure. Okay, so that what the state, our postulate one tells us there exists some density operator rho, which we can assign to the output of a preparation procedure. It doesn't tell us what state to assign, that depends on the physics of how you've built the box. And so similarly, we can just say, look, the correct way to describe the output state is something you determine. So the question here is, was this an ideal measurement? Was it not an ideal measurement? That kind of thing, which helps us determine what the right output state is. So the point is, Luder's rule is a provisional rule for much the same way that if you had an excited system with a decay time of 1 second and you wait 1,000 seconds, then you're pretty sure that system's going to be in its ground state. So after 1,000 seconds, you would ascribe the ground state as the state describing that system. So that's a provisional rule based on other physics, and similarly for the Luder's rule. All right, now, those are my comments. Any questions? Okay, so now I want to tell you next about composite systems and entanglement. So here, we'll go through the mathematical structure of composite systems in detail. We will discuss entanglement very briefly and come back to it in a more systematic way later. So for composite systems, so the first idea is that the algebra of accessible observables determines the Hilbert space structure of a system composed of multiple properties. Okay, so again, we have other physics telling us what the right structure is. But now I'll ask the question, how do we combine systems? How do we construct the classical state space of composite systems? Okay. So this is important. So basically, suppose we have, for physical states, so case one is for classical physical states, which are, you know, states of nature, or canonical variables. We have some system A, which is described by some properties, say XA, YA, ZA. So we're talking about a system in three dimensions here. So this is an element of R3. And then we can have a system B. Which has similarly some coordinate xb, yb, and zb, which is also an element of R3. What is the yes, sir?
I don't know if I understand the question. Why do you want to construct a classical state space?
Why? Well, what do you mean, why do you want to?
I mean, are you trying to bring the quantum picture to some classical and analog or something?
Be patient. We'll see. All right, so how do we combine these state spaces? Suppose you wanted to combine this. What is the combined state space? I want to describe it, systems A and B jointly. What is it?
Direct sum.
Sorry?
Direct sum.
Direct sum, thank you, sir. Okay, so systems A and B combined, the system which consists of A and B is described by XA, YA, ZA, my A's look like triangles, XB, YB, ZB, which is equal to R3 plus R3. Direct sum of the spaces. Okay, if I have, let me just, this is a bad board because you can't really see because the podium, so let me move over here. If I have N systems, each with state space RD, then the joint state space is RD times N. The state space does not grow exponentially with N. It grows linearly with N. Okay? Now, case two. Suppose I have classical states of uncertainty. Okay, these are probability states. Probability states, not physical properties. Not physical properties, but states of knowledge. Okay? What is the state space for system A? Okay, system A. It has three physical coordinates. Those physical coordinates live in R3. What space does the probability distribution describing the possible states of system 3? If I don't know what physical state it's in, system A, sorry, what is the space of the probabilities describing my knowledge of that system? We did this last class. We have a probability vector, which is an element of the 2 simplex, which is a subspace of R3. Okay, so we have this picture where we have property x, y, and z. Let's call this PA. And then the probabilities live on this triangular surface, which is like leaning up against the z-axis. And so the allowed values of P, this is 0, 0, 1, this is 0, 1, 0, this is 1, 0, 0 over here. These probabilities live in this triangle where, for example, the probability distribution in the middle of this triangle corresponds to the uniform probability 1/3, 1/3, 1/3, which means I have no information of where the system is. If I'm over here, it means I know with certainty that it's at position, that it's equal to x. With certainty, it's equal to y. With certainty, it's equal to z.
What is that superscript? Is that PA?
Yeah, PA. This is the system A. Because similarly, we're going to have system B. System B, which is described by a probability vector PB, which is my state of knowledge about that system. And that's an element of the 2 simplex, which is lives in R3. Now, suppose I have some correlations between systems A and B. Or maybe there's no correlations, but I want to jointly describe systems A and B. I want to just describe my joint knowledge, my knowledge of the joint system. What is the combined state space for the states of uncertainty? Tensor product. It's a tensor product, exactly. So for systems A and B, okay, we have a vector, let's call it Q, which describes A and B, which is the joint probabilities of my knowledge about the properties of A and B. This vector lives in delta 8, which is a subspace of R9, which is equal to the tensor product of R3 and R3. Okay? So now suppose I have, if I have n systems, each with P sub I in R3, where I is an element of 1 up to n, so it's referring to the nth system, then the state space of my description of the composite system, which is a state of knowledge, combines by a tensor product. So R for the total system is equal to 3 to the n. So the state space grows exponentially with the number of subsystems. Now, does that sound familiar? Okay, so what I wanted to do here, now I can answer your question. The point is that typically the tensor product structure of quantum mechanics is introduced as a feature of quantum mechanics. And that leads people to believe that it is part of the unique, innovative aspects of quantum mechanics, which makes people who are established researchers in the field of quantum information say the reason why quantum computers are more powerful is because the state space grows exponentially with the number of subsystems. But here we see that classical systems also have a state space growing exponentially with the number of subsystems. All right, when you don't have complete knowledge about the physical properties. These systems don't allow a speed up with Shor's algorithm. So that means we should take with a grain of salt the notion that the exponential growth of state space is somehow a unique quantum feature. Okay, so now that we've seen how the tensor product structure arises naturally in a classical setting, we can see that that exact same structure is duplicated in quantum mechanics. Okay, so now for quantum mechanics, we have a Hilbert space HA associated with system A. Similarly, we have a Hilbert space HB associated with system B. Then the joint description of both systems is assigned the Hilbert space HAB equal to HA tensor HB. So what this means is that if HA is spanned by an orthonormal basis, AK, and HB is spanned by BL. Let's make these spaces finite dimensional for simplicity. Let's let K run from 1 up to, what symbol do I use? Well, let's leave it unspecified for now. So these can be infinite sets. Then HA tensor HB is spanned by the set of vectors AK tensor BL. Hence, any state chi, which is an element of HA tensor HB, can be expressed as sum over L and K, some coefficients CLK, AL tensor BK. Is this, can you guys see that okay? So sorry, I should say these are orthonormal bases. These are all orthonormal bases. I guess I can use this backboard. I never use it, but here, I'll use it now. So I'll take the middle one, put it at the top. Okay, so just as a simple example, let HA equal to an m-dimensional Hilbert space. Let HB equal an n-dimensional Hilbert space. Then my description of systems A and B simultaneously are going to be Hilbert space HAB, which is equal to CM tensor CN, which is equivalent to CM times N. Yeah?
So we have introduced the direct product, the direct sum of spaces and the tensor product of spaces, but how does the Cartesian product fit in this story? Is that the tensor product in our case, or is it?
So that's a good question. Yeah, there's some notation issue there that I never quite sorted out. I think that the Cartesian product is the tensor sum for a classical phase space. But whether that holds kind of more generally, I'm not sure. But that's my provisional answer. Good question.
I thought the Cartesian product was like in the level of the sets. In that case, both the sum and the product would be the same thing. But if you take the operations inside, then they become different stuff.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So it's a question of kind of what level of description. You're talking about the vector space, or you're talking about the set. That makes sense. Yeah, maybe I'll look into that. That sounds like a good distinction to make. Any other questions? So the point here is that I didn't want to throw, first time I saw the tensor product structure of quantum mechanics, I was just kind of like, okay, this is just how it works. I have to learn this. This makes no sense to me at all. And so the point of motivating it the way I did was to give you guys some kind of context, something you can appeal to that's very natural and intuitive for understanding why we would have this mathematical structure for describing composite systems. Joint probability distributions satisfy the same structure. So it's nothing new. Okay, so now I have some really kind of pedantic stuff to cover. And again, I'm at a loss as to gauging how well you guys want pedantic stuff and whether you know it already. So I have a bunch of rules for manipulating sums and products of systems with the tensor product structure, states and observables. representation of the tensor product as matrices, that kind of thing. How many of you feel like that's all second hat, first hat? Is that expression?
Old hat.
Old hat, familiar. How many of you feel like that's something you don't want to see and would rather just learn on your own, or you already know it?
Is it all finite dimensional?
I don't think there's any specification of dimension. It's independent of dimension. It's just formal structure. So really only a half of, I only saw half of a hand raise. So you guys want to see this. Now, next question. How many of you would like to have a 5-minute break before we do something really pedantic like that? Some nods? All right, let's take a 5-minute break and then we'll go through the pedantic mathematics of it. All right, so just one quick note before we get into the properties of the tensor product. Just another example. So if you have an electron in three dimensions, and an electron, of course, has spin half, then you want to describe both the electron and its spin simultaneously, but the spin is an independent degree of freedom. And so you have C2 for the spin, tensor producted with the spatial wave function.
I have one more question about the classical system. Mm-hmm. I understand like the tensor product is basically the most general thing you can do. You're taking two completely separate things and you're just coupling them. Why can't the classical system go be a sum? Like, why is it that makes it special?
Well, again, the classical system, you have to be clear. Are we talking about the physical properties or the states of uncertainty? The physical properties are a sum.
Why
is it a sum? Well, I mean, if I have a single system and it's in the plane xy, then I describe that system with some vector v, and that vector v lives in R2.
Sure.
Now, if I say, oh, actually, I'm actually looking at the shadow of this system, and there's another dimension, another degree of freedom, which is the z coordinate, and that actually the true state is this. Let's call this v x y. This true state is some vector v in this three-dimensional space. And v is actually an element, so this is v x y. V is actually an element of R3, which is R2 plus R1. So we're adding in degrees of freedom, which is adding in components of the vector.
Right.
But this is kind of a single system with multiple properties. Then we describe two systems, it's the same thing. In some sense, one system in six dimensions is the same as two systems in three dimensions when we're talking about physical properties. When we're talking about states of knowledge, then that doesn't work that way. Two systems in three dimensions is a 9-dimensional state space for the states of knowledge about that system. So that's the key point, is that instead of it being 3 plus 3, it's 3 times 3, depending on what kind of state you're talking about.
Can you explain easily why it has to be a product then for the probability states?
Well, yeah, I mean, the point is, if my probability vector P has three components, Px, Py, Pz, we call this for system A, and then for system B, I have three components, PXB, PYB, PZB. Now I want to describe what's the joint probability of finding system one to have property Y and system two to have property Z. Right? The point is there are 9 different possible outcomes of this system. So now, if the system is uncorrelated, then the joint probability Q of finding system A to be in the state X and system B to be in the state Z, that is just the product of PXA times PBZ. But if there's correlations, then these will all be new things that aren't related to the independent components. So in fact, and if I give you the joint probability distribution, you can calculate the marginal probability distribution. And later on, we'll learn about the partial trace, which some of you may have seen already. So the partial trace on this quantum state is exactly analogous to marginalizing a probability distribution in the classical setting. So let me just make one more comment about, I was pressed after class about whether or not I'm claiming that there are hidden variables. Okay, so I'm not making that claim. Okay, what I'm saying is that we don't know the correct interpretation of quantum mechanics, first of all. Second of all, when you make the statement that quantum states are states of uncertainty, that's an empirical fact. It's not a statement of interpretation. Why? Because if the properties I'm talking about are the outcomes of tests, so if I have a spin one particle in some state, and I want to talk about measuring its z component of angular momentum, and measuring, or instead measuring its x component of angular momentum, the uncertainty principle guarantees that I cannot predict with certainty the outcomes of both those measurements because they don't commute. So I necessarily am describing uncertainty about the outcomes of future tests. So when we say quantum states are analogous to classical states of uncertainty, we can, the most conservative thing you can say, and this is a little bit like what Chris Fuchs argues, is that it's uncertainty about operational measurements I can apply to the system. And so at the very weakest level, you would expect quantum states to behave like classical states of knowledge, classical states of uncertainty, because that's what quantum states are. States of uncertainty about the things you can see, which are pointer positions on apparatuses. All right. Now that leaves open the possibility that there's states of uncertainty also about some underlying physical properties, but that's an open interpretational question. So with the one thing I would say is one thing that is pretty clear to me at least, but not to the rest of the community, is that we shouldn't think of quantum states as physical states, because then everything in quantum mechanics seems innovative and is totally different from classical mechanics. But if we think of quantum states as states of uncertainty, then large portions of quantum mechanics are completely like classical mechanics, and there's only a little bit left over, and it's that little bit that's left over that's the interesting piece. So in other words, you know, you have to don't aim low and think that everything about quantum mechanics is unique. Most of it isn't. And it's a question of, you know, how, looking at classical mechanics in the most general possible way is going to give you the highest bar that quantum mechanics has to pass in order to see what's truly innovative about it and understand its true potential and power for things like quantum information, superconductivity, and things like that. Okay, properties of the tensor product, something a lot less conceptually compelling here. So basically, how do we combine operators? So suppose we have some operator A, which is a linear operator acting on the Hilbert space for system A, and we have an operator B, which is a linear operator acting on the Hilbert space for system B, then we describe the operator acting on the joint system. You can think of this as like the momentum operator for particle one. This might be the position operator for particle two, or particle A and B, I should say. Then AB acts on some state chi. Write it this way. So let's let chi be an element of HA tensor HB. And now, because of what I told you already, this means that we can write chi as a linear combination with respect to some orthonormal basis, which is a, what this is called a product basis. Okay, so I'm getting ahead of myself a bit, but you can also span the joint Hilbert space by an entangled basis. So there's more than one basis, obviously. There's an infinite set of different bases for the Hilbert space. This basis for HA cross HB is a product basis, because each term in the basis is a product of two states that belong to HA and HB respectively. So then we can evaluate this operation. Basically, it's a linear operation, so we just have CLK A acting on AL cross B acting on BK. And if we have a scalar here, then the scalar just multiplies out like that. Okay, similarly, we have a linearity property. So if we have A tensor B plus C tensor D acting on some pair of states, psi tensor phi, then we just write this as A psi tensor B phi plus C psi tensor D phi. So this is composition, linearity, also linearity for states. Okay, this is a little bit tedious, but I think you guys get the picture. Alpha psi 1 plus beta psi 2 tensor producted with gamma phi 1 plus delta phi 2 is just write everything out. So you get alpha gamma psi 1 tensor phi 1 plus beta gamma psi 2 tensor phi 1, and then, you know, et cetera. Okay, so now we have dual vectors. Dual vectors. So if we have chi equal to alpha psi tensor phi, then we have the dual vector, which is alpha bar psi tensor phi. Okay, here's the piece you have to remember. Psi is system A, phi is system B. When we have the dual space, we keep the order of A and B. All right, so A is always on the left, B is always on the right. Okay, you don't swap the order when you take the dual vector. And you complex conjugate the coefficient, and then we have the inner product, which is psi tensor phi psi 2 tensor phi 2 just writes out as psi 1 psi 2 times phi 1 phi 2. So think about this as psi 1 is an element of the dual space. It's a linear functional which takes as input vectors in the space it's dual to. So psi 1 is an element of the dual space to A, and psi 2 is an element of A. Phi 1 is an element of the dual space to B. Phi 2 is an element of the Hilbert space HB. So the point is psi 1 goes and looks for the vector in HA, and that's the input to the linear functional, and the output is this scalar. And similarly for system B, so we get a product of the two scalars associated with inner products on each space. Okay, and then finally a comment about notation. Okay, so for notation, all of the following are equivalent depending on how lazy I get. Okay, so psi tensor phi means the same thing as psi A tensor phi B, which means the same thing as just writing psi phi, where we drop the product, which is the same thing as writing psi phi, where we put everything in one ket. Okay, so when you do wave mechanics, think about when you did a particle in a two-dimensional box, You took the wave function for the x coordinate and the wave function for the y coordinate, and you just multiplied them together. That's exactly what's happening here. Okay. So implicitly, when you did that, you were appealing to a tensor product structure, but it just wasn't explicit. Is there a question? Yeah.
Do you have Leibniz rule if you wanted the derivatives?
Which Leibniz rule are you thinking of here?
Like, I'm thinking, I wanted the Schrodinger equation for the ddt of everything. Do I distribute ddt?
Yeah, I mean, how would that work? I don't distribute ddt. Yeah, I don't think you distribute it.
You use your basis there. And you just take the derivatives of coefficients instead.
Yeah, but the it would act on the coefficients. Yeah. Right. So if the state is entangled, it's just going to be acting on this as a single. In a sense, I think if you're dealing, okay, I have to think about this, but I think that if I'm not missing something, the derivative operator, it kind of doesn't care about the tensor product structure. It's acting on this as just some vector in a bigger Hilbert space. Like, the point is, I have a Hilbert space, and whether I think of it as decomposing like this or not is irrelevant. If I'm taking the derivative of some vector in this, then I'm going to write that vector out in terms of a basis, and I'm going to reevaluate the derivative on the coefficients in that basis, which are these coefficients. So the derivative operator acts on the coefficients, not on the basis. The basis is fixed. It's like a lab frame. And then you have a vector that moves in the lab frame, and that means its components, the components of the vector with respect to that frame, change in time.
Right, but go, I don't know, okay, I don't know. If you go to, you know, like, have psi in one thing and phi in the other, forget about the component, just multiply them together, and you want the derivative of that.
Yes, the same.
Would that work?
All right, sorry, we didn't follow that, but
like psi t times phi t, and you want to take ddt of that, both of them.
Oh, would it be a product rule?
Yeah.
Oh, the product rule. Oh, yeah, it would.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, good. Okay, so the other piece, let me just do this so we're done with it. We have to go now from the abstract notation to matrix representations, which means we have to adopt a convention. So the representation, by which I mean matrix representation, of the tensor product, if we have some vector psi, which is an element of CM, which is our Hilbert space for system A, then we use an arrow to denote representation, which means we choose a basis. Once we choose a basis, psi has components in that basis. Okay, standard expansion. And then now what I can do is I can just write a column vector with respect. I mean, this is obviously, I'm sure this is completely trivial for you guys. Okay, so I'm talking about the column vector representation of this vector, which has m components. And similarly, if I have some state phi, which is an element of Cn, which is the Hilbert space of system B. Okay, this is finite dimensional, but doesn't have to be. I can have an infinite dimensional vector if it's an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. And then we would represent phi as phi 1, phi 2, all the way down to phi n. And now the question is, how do I represent chi? So if I have chi equal to psi tensor phi, then how do I represent chi? Well, chi will be represented, and now I pick a convention. Okay, so my convention is going to be that the rightmost system in the tensor product, the indices vary most rapidly. Okay, so rightmost system index varies most rapidly. So what that means is chi will look like this. It will be psi 1, phi 1, psi 1, phi 2. So the rightmost index is varying more rapidly all the way down to psi 1, phi n. Remember, these are just complex numbers. This is a normal product of complex numbers. And then this is psi 2, phi 1, And now hopefully you see the pattern all the way till you get down to psi m phi m. Okay? So I'll just say it in words. Rightmost index varies most rapidly.
You could also write it as a matrix, right? I mean,
it's also for the matrix. Yeah.
You could write it. No, the tensor product. You could write this as a matrix.
Yeah. The choice on the first class matrix.
So because then the first index would be the
You guys are way ahead of things. Okay, this is great. I'm sorry.
Is there an advantage if you use this one over the matrix notation? I'm just asking why, because I've never seen this notation. I've seen this before as a matrix.
But we do have the alpha.
As an n by m matrix.
What is an n by m? The density operator.
No, the product state. The tensor product, you just write as psi I phi j, and then you have a matrix.
Okay, I've never seen that.
But in that case, you won't have operators.
Sorry?
In that case, your operators.
It's just a brand
new. So if we have some operator O, which is equal to A tensor B, where A is represented as some matrix A11, A12, A1m.
Because you're having a column vector. You just want to have a column vector.
And B is represented as B11. Oh, this is N. Okay, then what we do is we take A tensor B and we represent it as A11 times the full matrix B, A12 times the full matrix B, and so on. Okay, so what that corresponds to is it's going to be A11, B11, A11, B12, A11, B21, and so on. Okay, we should probably stop there. At the beginning of next class, we'll talk about entanglements. And then I'll have some discussion with Aggie about what we should do after that. But yeah, we'll talk about entanglement and the Schmidt decomposition tomorrow. Okay, thanks for all the good questions. That was a lot of fun. I'm glad you guys are warming up to me and we're getting more lively interactions, getting a better sense of the spectrum of backgrounds, so that's good. But yeah, keep it coming and we'll see you tomorrow.